WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Eggland's Best.
I'm Stacy Lynn. At least 24 people are dead in central Texas after a month's worth of rain fell in just a few hours, causing catastrophic flash flooding. CBS's Christiane Benavides reports while the total number of missing is still not known.
Among those unaccounted for, more than 20 children who were attending a Christian summer camp, Texas Governor Greg Abbott.
Whatever these communities need, the state of Texas is going to step up and provide it.
President Donald Trump said he's working with the governor on any federal assistance that may be required. The flood is a result of torrential downpours, causing the Guadalupe River to swell over 25 feet within an hour, washing away homes, vehicles, and roads.
Correspondent Scott McFarlane reports the FBI agents are getting put back on counterterrorism duty because of what Attorney General Pam Bondi calls potential Iranian threats.
Iran, of course, is a threat. They have been a threat, and they always will be a threat to our country.
But CBS News has learned agents at the FBI and the Department of Justice have warned supervisors they'd been pulled away from counterterrorism to focus on immigration enforcement. And there's been a purge of several top counterterror officials and dozens of experienced prosecutors in the Department of Justice in the opening months of President Trump's term.
While they call the discussions positive, Hamas hasn't formally accepted a ceasefire proposal yet. The BBC's Ione Wells in Jerusalem with one thing they may be holding out for.
They want an end to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, that controversial U.S. and Israeli-backed aid distributor in Gaza. This organization has been mired in controversy since it started operating in Gaza in late May, not least because of the near-daily reports of Palestinians being shot at by IDF soldiers while trying to seek aid.
With the price at the pump down, tens of millions of people hit the road for the long holiday weekend.
The record number of Americans traveling for the 4th of July holiday, including CJ Kennedy, are enjoying a break from high gas prices.
It's been very economical to travel.
AAA says average gas prices are at their lowest for this time of the year since 2021.
That's CBS's Jim Crisilla on the road in Hillsville, Virginia. Actor Julian McMahon has died. He was best known for playing Dr. Doom in the Fantastic Four movies and plastic surgeon Dr. Christian Troy on Nip Tuck.
Right eye is half a millimeter higher than your left. We could properly fix that with the malar augmentation. That's a cheekbone enhancement. I'll give you Botox here and here.
McMahon was 56 years old. This is CBS News.
Nothing makes a gathering great like Eggland's Best eggs. They're just so delicious, with better nutrition, too. For us, it's eggs any style, as long as they're the best. Eggland's Best.
As Wisconsin is brats on the grill for a tailgate, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Civic Media News, I'm Terry Barr. If you're spending more time outside this holiday weekend, experts are warning about a new breed of tick and the bizarre allergy it can spread with just one bite. It's known as the Lone Star tick, and the bug is finding its way to Wisconsin from the southeast part of the country. Doctors with Mayo Clinic say they're already starting to see more patients with what's known as alpha-gal syndrome. It's an allergy to red meat after being bit by this type of tick. And these ticks aren't just in the woods.
You go back 30 years ago and you'd think of, a hunter, an avid hiker out in the woods. Now we're starting to see ticks pop up sometimes in backyards in suburban areas and stuff like that. And that's a concern.
PJ Leash is an entomologist at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And though this new tick is spreading, he still considers Lyme disease from a deer tick the bigger concern. Leash also suggests using insect spray, wearing long sleeves and pants, and always checking for ticks after spending time outside. Are you noticing farmers spending more time outside working in the fields? The weather in some parts of the state is challenging and may not mean all the corn crops are knee-high by the 4th of July. The latest crop report shows farmers across Wisconsin had just 3.5 days with workable conditions during the last week. And did you know our state is ranked second for having the most organic farms in the country? Officials with Naturally Wisconsin and the Food Finance Institute are starting a new program to support those efforts and say there's also growing consumer demand for natural, healthy, and sustainable products. The group's already working with more than 800 food-focused entrepreneurs from all across the state. You can find more news anytime at civicmedia.us. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Download the Civic Media app in the Google Play or Apple App Store and take us everywhere. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Showers and thunderstorms today, highs in the low 80s. Tonight, showers and storms clear out. We'll see a low around 61. For Sunday, mostly sunny, highs near 81. For Monday, mostly sunny and a high near 81. More showers and thunderstorms possible Monday night.
It's 73 at our studios.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday, we'll review the holiday weekend. Hope yours has been good. Also, Kristen Lierley, John and Gordy, and Jane Matinair will join us as well.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Matinair on Air.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this, the second hour of our weekly weekend broadcast of all things related to the rule of law and justice, the delivery of justice, and the operation of government. And as always, we appreciate so very much your calls, your inquiries, your questions about all sorts of things, including the subject matter of our first hour, and that is broad takeaways from the Supreme Court's last term, including some substance in the areas of the capacity of federal district judges to act in furtherance of their oaths of office and to resolve disputes among parties who have legitimate claims against each other. Second, a major case involving the future of academics in America and the capacity of parents to direct what is and is not taught in our schools. And beyond that, an awful lot of procedural things coming out of this past term, including these dissents, which in many ways have become a whole lot more vociferous, to use a very diplomatic word. We talked before about the heated exchange between Amy Coney Barrett and Ketanji Brown Jackson in that CASA case. Almost coming to blows, if you will, at least linguistically. And that is a level of animosity that we have seen perhaps in small doses before, but not at the level that we've seen in this past term. The ideological split that has always existed, we see it again this term, even while we see some unanimous decisions coming out of the Supreme Court. And perhaps most importantly, procedurally, we see the increasing use and the application of this emergency docket, whereby petitioners, including the government, most often in the past 5 months, but others in history, coming to the Supreme Court while underlying litigation is still going on and asking for their immediate intervention, and the Supreme Court granting that, and the problem being that when they act that quickly with that emergency power, they don't give us reasons why. They don't have the benefit of argument, and we are left to guess about the reasons why a majority of the court directed that something happened without an explanation, without the transparency that we know in the other branches, including the executive branch, including the legislative branch. That is a problem I would offer across the board for a Supreme Court that should indeed be deciding cases and telling us the reasons why they decide those cases. It's also the focus of an awful lot of the dissenting opinion in some of these cases, in which they bemoan the fact that the majority has not explained why it is they're doing what they're doing and leaving the dissenters and leaving litigants to guess at what the Supreme Court actually means. Lots of things happening at our Supreme Court, even as they begin to fill up their docket in the coming 2025-2026 term. We know that they will continue to focus on religious issues. They have had a special focus on that, as they have had just this past term. And indeed, transgender issues. We know that there are at least two cases coming out of the Supreme Court, one of them in the emergency docket, permitting the president to terminate the tenures of transgender military members, even while the underlying litigation is going on. Also, that other major case coming out of Tennessee and transgender issues, finding that indeed a legislature can restrict the administration of hormone therapies and various medicines blocking puberty to provide support for youth who are undergoing transition. Finding that indeed the legislatures can impose restrictions on that, and effectively saying, as John Roberts did, that because there is so much difference of opinion about this, we'll leave that to the legislature. Transgender issues looming large in this past term, and once again in the coming term, the Supreme Court announced just this past week that it's going to hear two more cases. They're similar in nature. They're coming out of a couple of states. Those states banning transgender athletes from participating in sports. That's coming up in the coming term. And so presumably with that case, unlike at least the military case, you'll have the exposition of views in both directions, oral argument, and probably sometime around this time next year, a disposition of that case as well. Lots of substantive issues coming out of the Supreme Court, promise for the future as well. Some procedural things that we should also be attentive to as our Supreme Court makes these major decisions that affect our lives and livelihoods. As always, we appreciate the callers and the comments from our listeners. And Mark, we appreciate calling in from Prairie du Sac. We appreciate your participation in our broadcast this weekend.
Yeah, it's especially significant, you know, coming up now. We are in the 249th anniversary of our Declaration of Independence. And part of it mentioned in there is the courts. I mean, that, and they were fully developed in the Constitution. But they were upset with the fact that, you know, these courts are making secret decisions. They seem to be answerable only to, you know, to the king himself. And that the courts are supposed to be, you know, the last refuge of defending our constitutional rights as well. And that when the Constitution actually says that you're born in this country, you are a citizen of this country, and all the justices, they take an oath, as do many officers of the courts, they take an oath to support the Constitution, to actually follow the Constitution, and how they, what kind of sophistry that this court has engaged in to avoid actually just coming out and saying, you know, to serve one man, you know, Donald Trump, who, you know, is, by every definition, he's becoming a tyrant. I mean, that I texted in earlier, you know, the quote from the Declaration of Independence is that the man seems to, you know, incapable of obeying the Constitution itself, and the Supreme Court should actually say something, because what they've made Donald Trump is what the anti-federalists are actually afraid of, is that they're afraid that we would have a king who was a monarch, you know, surrounded by minions and mistresses, and with ISIS doing right now, I would maintain that they're getting awfully close to the murderous janissaries that, you know, Hamilton tried to argue against, that the president was not going to have.
And Mark, again, an awful lot of, yeah, what the Supreme Court has done recently, I agree with you, has given him an awful lot more power, and future presidents as well. This is not just for Donald Trump as well. And again, we do take a look at the Declaration of Independence. One of the principal grievances of our founding fathers was this notion that we're doing things contrary to our fundamental systems that do, in fact, contemplate going to the courts and seeking redress of grievances. We may not always be successful. We may win. We may lose. But that notion that you don't do what a judge says, which we've also seen in many of these cases, we tell judges, no, we're not doing that. We make decisions based upon our own prerogatives, contrary to the rule of law. That's what our founding fathers were in many ways disputing when it comes to the king, many, 249 years ago and beyond. The other point that you make is a good one, which is it would have been cleaner and neater for the Supreme Court to issue a decision resolving the core issue having to do with the 14th Amendment, saying what it has said before, which is that if you're born here, you are a citizen of the United States of America. And the Supreme Court, once again, having said that previously, it makes clear sense bringing all of this to conclusion, not having to get involved also in this issue about national as opposed to regional or even district specific injunctions. All of that making things much more complicated for not just this president, not just for challengers to this president, but now for anyone who seeks to vindicate constitutional dimension rights. All of that, a significant part of what the Supreme Court has done. I thank you so much for bringing that to our attention as we celebrate this weekend the 249th anniversary of our nation. Also want to comment that Mark from Sussex wrote in. I will not repeat exactly what he has said. I'll strip away some of the name calling, but indicating that, yes, indeed, when individuals in America are not successful in a political realm or in other areas, they go into court. And Mark, I agree with you that is the mechanism through which we do things here, recognizing that judges who take an oath of office to be fair and impartial, we can criticize them. We do that. That's the First Amendment stuff. But that, too, is our system. And indeed, there are times when failures in the political system end up in the courts. Failures in the court system end up in a legislative or an executive branch. That's a part of our system, too. So, Mark, I appreciate what is implicitly in your comment here on Amicus A Law Review. Let's talk more about a Supreme Court, and that's the Wisconsin Supreme Court that just this past week issued a major decision of its own. Supreme Court routinely doing the same kinds of things, which both Marks this weekend have embraced and talked about, which is resolving differences, sometimes in unanimous opinions, sometimes not. This past week, the United States Supreme Court, again, making decisions about those future cases, even while our Wisconsin Supreme Court is striking down an 1849 law, again, in a split court. What happened just this past week? Well, we know that in 2022, at the pen of Justice Samuel Alito, the United States Supreme Court found that about 49 years of history in America, privacy rights that inhere in the Constitution, a privacy right that gives women the right to make decisions about their own bodies and pursue reproductive rights with their doctors, including the right and access to abortion. That's, of course, Roe versus Wade. That's Casey. Other cases since 1973 overturned decisively, clearly, unmistakably in 2022, Supreme Court saying that Roe versus Wade was improperly, unfairly, unreasonably decided. And so finding that there is, in fact, no privacy right inside the Constitution, the federal Constitution, therefore going back to the states. And indeed, we'll talk in just a moment or so about what the consequence of that has been across the country. But one of the consequences right here in the state of Wisconsin is that we had, reference past tense, an 1849 law, basically an abortion ban here in the state of Wisconsin. And basically that 1849 law said that anyone other than a pregnant woman who intentionally destroys the life of an unborn child could face 6 years in prison, a $10,000 fine. Only exception to the abortion ban accomplished by that law back in 1849 was for what's called a therapeutic abortion to save the life of the mother. Well, again, a lot of controversy about that. Along the way, we had a lower court judge finding that the 1849 law does not prohibit abortion. Appellate work on this, the Supreme Court at various times indicating that the case should be resolved. And it goes into the Dane County courts back in 2023, finding that the 1849 ban was not valid. And all sorts of things going on in the lower courts that lead up to what happened just this past week, in which a majority by 4-3 are striking down the ban, striking down the 1849 abortion ban, and finding that because of all the things that have happened
all the things that have happened since the time of 1849, that 1849 law was effectively rescinded, effectively no longer in place anyway. The court basically saying that there have been so much legislation that contemplates implicitly, if not explicitly, that abortion is legal in the state of Wisconsin, that it plainly intended that the abortion ban no longer be in place. Here's what the Supreme Court says. Wisconsin Supreme Court says in support of that conclusion. Supreme Court says comprehensive legislation enacted over the last 50 years regulating in detail the who, what, where, when, and how of abortion so thoroughly covers the entire subject of abortion that it was meant as a substitute for the 19th century near total ban on abortion. That's what the Supreme Court said at its key ruling. When we come back, we'll talk more about what that means here in the state of Wisconsin, what the court said, and indeed what it means throughout the United States of America as other states continue to wrestle with this issue of reproductive rights in America in the early part of the 21st century. Stay with us for all of that.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Ever since I started the recombobulation area, I've written an in-depth breakdown of every new edition of the Marquette University Law School poll. The newest poll asks about a range of topics, whether Tony Evers should run for a third term, where people stand on Donald Trump's economic policies, and a host of issues relating to the state budget. The poll paints a picture of a polarized Wisconsin. Many people are very dug into their partisan camps, which is perhaps to be expected in the most evenly divided state in the nation. But there are a number of issues polled that do have the support of more than two-thirds of Wisconsin voters. Those include extending Medicaid coverage for new moms, legalizing marijuana, making major increases in state aid for special education, providing mental health services in schools, allowing citizen-led ballot initiatives, and banning cell phones in schools. What do most of these issues have in common? They are policies being advanced by Democrats in Wisconsin.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
It's the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. The website climate.gov is no more. The site that served as a trusted resource for federal research on climate change has been officially shut down a month after its staff was fired by the Trump administration. When it was online, climate.gov received hundreds of thousands of visitors every month. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says climate information will be housed elsewhere on its website. $16 million in state funding could soon be on the way to help farmers improve water quality in rural Wisconsin. The Joint Committee on Finance recently committed the funding for a host of environmentally-minded farm programs after months of work from Clean Wisconsin and its partners. The funding still needs to be passed by the full legislature and signed into law by Governor Evers. Knowledge is power. For a deep dive into Wisconsin's most pressing environmental issues, check out my Defender podcast at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mommy, how come I can't sit in the front seat?
Because I love you and you're just not ready yet.
Putting your kids in the right seat for their age and size is an act of love. Check that your kids are in the right seat at NHTSA.gov/the right seat. Love protects. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Download the Civic Media app in the Google Play or Apple App Store and take us everywhere. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for these remaining segments of this second hour of our program here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, celebrating, as we noted, the 249th anniversary of our nation and the processes of government, including the checks and balances among the executive branch and the judicial branch, the legislative branch, a constant recurring theme here on our broadcast. Talking now about one of those branches of government, actually involving many branches of the government here in the state of Wisconsin, the decision by our Wisconsin Supreme Court just this past week to find that this 1849 law that
that prohibited abortion in the state of Wisconsin no longer valid based upon all the legislative activities and events that have happened since the time of the passage of that law. Once again, the majority writing that the who, what, where, when, and how abortion in all those pieces of legislation so thoroughly covers all kinds of things related to the reproductive rights that plainly the 1849 law, as we interpret it and understand the legislative intent, can no longer stand. The court along the way, to get a bit legalistic, says that it's historically set a very high bar for an implied repeal. That's the legal term for, by virtue of your conduct, you haven't officially announced that you're repealing, but you impliedly repealed the lower court or another court or previous decision. But in this case, the majority found that the legislature had met that bar by entirely revising the state law on abortion. So had, in fact, engaged in an implied repeal of the 1849 law. The court goes on to say, indeed, these statutes specify, often in extraordinary detail, the answer to nearly every conceivable question about abortion. This is from the pen of Associate Justice Rebecca Dalich. She's writing for the 4-3 majority. She says, who may perform abortions? Only doctors. What about another question? Where may abortions be performed? Within 30 miles of a hospital where the doctor has admitting privileges. Another question, when may abortions be performed? Prior to viability or 20 weeks of pregnancy, except when necessary to preserve the life or health of the mother or in a medical emergency. What she's quoting from are all the pieces of legislation that have been enacted since 1849, again, impliedly repealing that law and finding that abortion is legal in the state of Wisconsin, clearly and dispositively, and healthcare providers can provide this particular service to their patients as a part of the healthcare treatment given to them. A significant decision not only for reproductive rights and privacy rights here in the state of Wisconsin, but also for the way in which it was accomplished. And plainly, we have dissenters to that. There can continue to be dissenting views. That's, again, what we embrace about our nation and our state. You can be critical of that opinion. We embrace the process. And indeed, that's what's going on in other states around the country. Taking this opportunity now to chat about what the status of abortion is across the country, again, in the wake of our own state Supreme Court. 19 states ban abortion or restrict the procedure earlier in pregnancy than the standard that was set in Roe versus Wade way back in 1973. That, as I indicated, once again, that was the standard for about 49 years, and it was overturned in 2022. In many states, the fight, just as it was in Wisconsin until just this past week, about abortion continues. And that's taking place in all those different venues. It's taking place in courtrooms where various advocates have sued to block bans and restrictions. Other states have moved to expand access to abortion by adopting, in some cases, you've got constitutional amendments that they've enacted that have permitted abortion and privacy rights to be expanded. And sometimes they've added legal protections in those kinds of legislative and constitutional enactments. And so what about the legality of abortion generally? It is broadly legal in about 31 states and the District of Columbia. In Wyoming, the procedure remains legal for now. Courts there determining whether separate laws banning most abortions can take effect. So kind of a variation on what the Supreme Court here in Wisconsin was wrestling with, still going on in Wyoming. More than half of the states where abortion is legal limit the procedure, as we do in Wisconsin, to around fetal viability. That's the word that we've all been wrestling with since Roe versus Wade, through Dobbs and beyond. That's the point at which a fetus could survive outside the uterus, and that's somewhere around 24 weeks of pregnancy. It's one of the reasons why Roe versus Wade was overcome, if you will, by the Casey case, did not rescind the right to an abortion, but just abandoned a very, very structured mechanism for understanding trimesters. Now, the principle in those states is viability, somewhere around 24 weeks or so. Dozens of states, as I said, have added protections since the Dobbs decision. That's how they responded to the decision by the Supreme Court saying you no longer have a federal right, but they have done that to preserve or expand access to the right. Many have passed abortion shield laws. What are those all about? Well, those provide legal protections for both patients and providers in states where abortion is legal. And basically shielding healthcare providers, arguably even the patients themselves, from prosecution by other states that are out there. Eight states have gone even further by enacting telemedicine shield laws that aim to protect doctors and others who prescribe and send abortion pills in the mail to patients located in states where the ban exists. We saw that recently in the case involving New York and Texas, this sparring between the governors of those two states about whether an attempt to find a New York doctor responsible for prescribing to a patient in Texas is something that would be illegal there. The governor of New York saying, not in my state, won't happen. That's the shield concept. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about abortion, and then we'll get on to some other cases that have been decided in the criminal and civil courts just this past week here on Amicus, a Law Review.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, the Valley's home of Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
CBS News Brief. At least 23 children who were spending part of their summer at a sleepaway camp near San Antonio are unaccounted for after flash flooding.
President Donald Trump said he's working with the governor on any federal assistance that may be required.
CBS's Christian Benavides. Hamas is demanding changes before it accepts a proposed ceasefire plan for Gaza. From Jerusalem, the BBC's Ione Wells says one of the sticking points is the U.S.-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
This organization has been in controversy since it started operating in Gaza in late May because of the near daily reports of Palestinians being shot at by IDF soldiers while trying to seek aid.
If, like millions of Americans, you're on the road this holiday weekend, you'll be paying a lot less for a gallon of gas than you have in a few years, says CBS's Jim Crisula in Hillsville, Virginia.
AAA says average gas prices are at their lowest for this time of the year since 2021.
CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers in Miami. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers and the Marlins going at it this afternoon in South Florida, where it's hot, humid, and in the 90s. Last night, the Brewers held on to beat the Marlins 6-5, thanks to closer Trevor McGill getting his 19th save of the season. Pat Murphy asked, why did he decide to keep McGill in the game despite two men on and the Marlins slugger Otto Lopez at the plate?
I know I'm looking at the clock, and what time was it? I looked at the clock, and it was like 9:48, and I'm like, Milwaukee's an hour behind, and when am my kid's going to go to bed, so I got to be able to FaceTime to go to bed. So that was one thing I was thinking. The other thing I was thinking of is just how proud I am of McGill. Just every big situation, he's just a great competitor, you know, and keeps coming at you. Close call, whatever, it doesn't affect him. It's just, he's been sensational. That's what I was thinking about. When my kids are going to go sleep so I can FaceTime them, and then that. What else was I thinking about? Like all the things I was thinking about? I mean, I had a lot of things on my mind.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Showers and thunderstorms today, highs in the low 80s. Tonight, showers and storms clear out. We'll see a low around 61. For Sunday, mostly sunny, highs near 81. For Monday, mostly sunny and a high near 81. More showers and thunderstorms possible Monday night.
It's 73 at our studios.
Can I sit in the front seat? Just this one time? Please, please, please?
No, not yet.
But why?
Because I love you, and you're just not ready yet. Now, get in the back so I can get you in your car seat, please.
Putting your kids in the right seat for their age and size is an act of love. Check that your kids are in the right seat at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Love protects. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Matt Nair on Air.
PJ Leash, the bug guy, he heads the entomology department at UW-Madison, and we are talking ticks.
When a deer tick transmits Lyme disease, it takes 36 hours, so about a day and a half. And that's why, in my mind, one of the single best things you can do as a precaution is to do regular tick checks. Because you've removed it, your risk goes down greatly to basically zilch.
Matt Nair on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Tracy Ann Mangold, how would you describe what it is that Brian Schimming is caught in the crossfires of?
He's the first paid state chair that they've ever had. And so the belief was that maybe that'll increase his ability to fundraise for the state. Obviously, that has not worked out so well. I've been told that he thinks 4 phone calls a day to fundraise is a lot, which, you know, isn't.
104 might be a good start.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Snakes, zombies, public speaking, the list of fears is endless. But the real danger is in your hand when you're behind the wheel. Distracted driving is what's really scary, and even deadly. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Pat Kreitlow.
On Monday, we'll review the holiday weekend. Hope yours has been good. Also, Kristen Lyerly, John and Gordy, and Jane Matinair will join us as well.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, weekdays 6 to 9.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for these remaining segments in this weekend's analysis of all things rule of law related. Spending appropriately some time talking about this major decision of our Wisconsin Supreme Court that struck down this 1849 abortion ban, and finding that because the state legislature has done an awful lot of things when it comes to the who, what, where, when, how, and why of how reproductive services can be provided here in Wisconsin, what that implicitly means is that the 1849 law was never effective while all that legislation was being enacted, is not effective today, this implied repeal notion. And because of all the questions that have been answered by subsequent legislation in the wake of 1849, the 1849 law no longer applies, began to talk a little bit more about the national scope of things and noting that, yes, indeed, as many people predicted on all sides of this aisle, that in the wake of the 2022 decision written by Justice Alito, finding once again that there is no privacy right in the Constitution to abortion, in the wake of that, you will get a patchwork of states around the country that do this differently. Indeed, that's exactly what you've got. And this is not going to be an exhaustive presentation on all of that, but you do have places like Alabama and Arkansas and Louisiana and Mississippi and Oklahoma where abortion is banned in almost all circumstances. You've got other places. We've talked about some of these. For example, remember the situation in Florida, for example, where there was an attempt to accomplish some changes there. They were not effective in the end, but the result was that there is right now a 6-week ban on abortion in the state of Florida. And the people went to the polls in that state, attempted along the way to get a result. And 2024, that's when a majority of voters supported that ballot measure that would have enshrined the right there in that state to abortion. But it fell short procedurally of 60% of the voters needed to win. And so today there is a 6-week ban on abortion in Florida. Other places, like Texas, abortion is banned in almost all circumstances. Private citizens can sue abortion providers and those who assist patients who are seeking an abortion after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. That's in Texas. At the other end of the spectrum, we've got California. The California Supreme Court recognized a right to abortion and voters explicitly there enshrined codified abortion protections in the state constitution in 2022, the same year that Dobbs was decided. State law also shields those who are seeking or providing abortions in California from laws in other states, regardless of the patient's location. That, for example, is in California, Massachusetts. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court has recognized the right to abortion under the state constitution. Viability is once again the standard there. State law shields those seeking or providing abortions from those laws in other states. We know that as well. And as we go through the entire group here, for example, in Pennsylvania, there's a 24-week legal limit. An executive order shields those seeking or providing abortions in Pennsylvania from laws in other states. That also happening again in other states throughout the nation. We know, for example, in Illinois, just to our south here in Wisconsin, once again, the standard is viability. There, the state Supreme Court has recognized abortion protections under the state constitution. State law does it once again protect the procedure and shield people seeking or providing abortions in Illinois from those other states. All sorts of things going on throughout the United States of America. Tennessee abortion is banned in almost all circumstances. New Hampshire abortion is not expressly protected by state law, but there's a 24-week standard there in that state. And again, the point of this is we do, after Dobbs, 3 years after Dobbs, have a variety of different approaches across the country when it comes to the providing of reproductive services in America, very much predicted at the time that the Supreme Court issued that decision in Dobbs. It is true. Now Wisconsin takes its place where abortion is legal. And viability, once again, about 24 weeks, is the standard here in our state. There have been other things going on in the courts of America. We have not spent a lot of time here in Amicus, a law review, talking about some of the other cases in the criminal context involving individual defendants. Both of them, both of these particular cases surfaced this week, although they've been percolating for a very long time in trial and in pretrial proceedings, respectively. The first one involves Sean Combs, who know this well. He was convicted just this past week of transporting prostitutes to participate in drug-fueled events, sex events, that were described with great, great particularity in the weeks-long trial. Significantly, the jury, after a lot of back and forth, at one point they came forward and said, "Judge, we cannot decide this case." They acquitted him in the end of the principal charges, the major charges of racketeering conspiracy. That's that RICO charge, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act charge. That's the big federal charge against him. And also sex trafficking in violation similarly of the federal criminal code. Those were the most serious charges against him. And the jury came back and said, we do not find you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of those major charges. Undeniably a disappointment for the prosecutors. Plainly a matter for some, maybe not jubilation, although Mr. Combs and his attorneys were both almost in a jubilant mood after the convictions were only for transporting prostitutes as a result of the jury verdict. Plainly a disappointment for prosecutors who felt strongly and presented a strong case against this defendant in support of this racketeering charge. It was at the core of the indictment against him. This, again, in federal court. This is a federal charge. And the judge, Judge Aram Subramanian ordered Mr. Combs, who has been held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, back to jail until his sentencing, even on those other charges. He remains in custody. Attorneys will certainly seek his release and could return again to court to do just that very, very soon. But all of that happening in a Manhattan federal courtroom just this past week. Across the country in Colorado, another case of great national notoriety, this one involving this fellow named Brian Koberger. Recall the horrific events in this case as well. He's this PhD student. He's at the University of Idaho, Moscow, Idaho. And you recall well that in November of 22, he is responsible for killing, brutally murdering four University of Idaho students, stabbed to death in the middle of the night in their home near campus. Now, for a long period of time, obviously, Mr. Koberg remained of the position that he was not guilty, took that posture, as is his right. We recognize, like Mr. Combs, like Mr. Koberger, that charges are just that, that they do in fact convey a sense of probable cause that you have committed these crimes, but not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, in a different disposition of the sort that we saw in Manhattan with respect to Sean Combs, there a verdict of a jury finding him guilty of some counts, not guilty of others. He will still be sentenced there, probably to somewhere around something less than the 20 years or so that he is exposed to, but maybe several years in prison. Koberger did not go to trial, although every indication was that he was going to do just that. In fact, what he does is he pleads guilty. He pleads guilty there, and he acknowledges in a plea hearing of just this past week that he did indeed murder those four students. And that, of course, comes in the wake of an exhaustive investigation, you may remember this, involving DNA swabs and tying him across country, where he was in Pennsylvania, to the murder back in Colorado. All kinds of fascinating law enforcement work done in support of the finding of probable cause, first, that he engaged in that horrific, murderous, homicidal conduct. Now, once again, going to trial, he has a right to defend against that. That trial right he has now given up. And the judge, during the course of his plea colloquy, says you're pleading guilty because you are guilty. And Koberger responds, yes. And that means that there will be no trial in that case. And once again, prompting some differing views about the disposition here. Why? Because of the circumstances under which he pled guilty. By virtue of entering his plea, Mr. Koberger there in that court has said that, yes, indeed, I acknowledge that under the law, the judge will be obliged to sentence me to prison for the rest of my life without parole. He will spend the rest of his life in prison without a chance of parole. What he does get out of this arrangement, the plea agreement, is that the prosecutors agree not to seek the death penalty, not to put him to death for the conduct that he was engaging in. And that, plainly, like the Sean Combs verdict, which is causing some levels of disagreement and views in all directions, this one also prompting people, including members of the victim families, some of them saying, yes, I am glad that we do not have to go through a trial where we have to hear about the circumstances, and they are brutal and they are graphic, that the investigators know about the situation involving his actual murder of these four. Glad that we do not have to go through a trial. Glad this is brought to an end and we can begin to move on, including a sentencing hearing, at which the victim families will plainly have the opportunity to speak. That's their called their right of elocution. Others, both in families and also in the public, saying no, he should have been tried, and the government should have preserved the right to pursue the death penalty for this horrific nature of this conduct. He should have been put to death. Again, appropriate to have that discussion in America about the disposition. Interestingly, we may find out more about it, but we still don't know exactly the motive for Koberger's engaging in this terrible, terrible murderous rampage back in November of 2022. Maybe we'll find out more at the sentencing, and maybe not. We do not know how that particular information piece will play out. What we do know, and the reason why I identify both of these cases completely different in venue and completely different in the nature of the charges against them, completely different in the context of the ways in which they were disposed of. Again, Combs is the recipient of a jury verdict. He went to trial. He's got that right under our system to be tried by a jury. The jury came back what can only be described as a split verdict. He will still be sentenced by the judge and will probably, as I said, spend some time in prison. Koberger decides to waive his right to a jury trial, which again is constitutionally guaranteed to him. And in exchange for that, the prosecution says we will not seek what we could also seek under the the law, which is the imposition of the death penalty as to you. And that is what he, Koberger, receives as a result of this arrangement. Now, why again do I raise both of these things? You've seen all of these dispositions in the news. They are different and they are disparate, not only in geography, but also in disposition. It is because even in the midst of these horrific events, and yes, indeed, without now convicting Sean Combs of the sex trafficking and RICO violations for which he was acquitted, the conduct itself, including the transportation of individuals for prostitution, is condemnable. We know that. As we know that the murderous event in Utah, similarly so. When we come back, I'll draw this to a conclusion, explain why in both of these cases the rule of law is upheld, and why, without in any way celebrating these results, we should nonetheless acknowledge that justice proceeds apace in America, when we continue here on Amicus, a Law Review.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Thomas Jefferson is credited with most of the text of the Declaration of Independence, but the independence part came from a Virginian named Richard Henry Lee on June 7, 1776. The First Continental Congress sent a list of grievances in 1774 to King George III, among them the loss of their rights under English law, the occupation by British forces in peacetime, and the oppressive coercive acts passed by Parliament to shut down colonial unrest. The King and Parliament didn't respond other than to pass more restrictive laws. By mid-May 1776, 8 colonies supported independence, including Virginia, which directed its delegates to support independence at the Second Continental Congress. Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee, on June 7th, presented his resolution for independence to the Congress in Philadelphia, which tabled action until July 2nd. In the interim, Thomas Jefferson, with light editing by Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, crafted a statement which would become the Declaration of Independence, which included Richard Henry Lee's independence resolution word for word. Resolved that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is, and ought to be, totally dissolved. Read the full Declaration of Independence at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
At Hazelden Betty Ford, treating mental health isn't just about breaking old patterns. It's about braving new ones. As the leader in alcohol and drug treatment for 75 years, we know caring for addiction, anxiety, depression, and trauma goes hand in hand. We're here for you with new tools when life breaks down at our new clinic in Hudson. Discover your path to better mental health at HazeldenBettyFord.org/Hudson. Sponsored by Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Years ago, I had some, I had a rainbow. No, it was a shirt. It was given to me and I wore it because I support all people. And a friend of mine, like, you sure you want to walk around in that? You know, a t-shirt, people might think. I'm like, people might think I'm a human being that supports other human beings. I wore sports jerseys sometimes. No one ever says, are you worried people are going to think you're on the Cubs?
I don't think anyone would think that though.
Oh, you haven't seen my curveball.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
Madam Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway from the fabulous city of Madison.
A lot of people say, I don't like politics. It's all dirty and angry and blah, blah, blah. It's really about caring about your community, finding a way to, like, bring it back to people talking to each other.
Yeah.
About what is important in our place and how do we take care of each other and use the levers of government to do that. That's really what it's about.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m. Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. This is the final segment of our weekend, our Independence Weekend broadcast here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. talking about the broader implications of these two major cases. That is involving this former criminology student in Idaho pleading guilty, admitting to killing brutally four Idaho students way back in November 22. And at the other end of our nation, Sean Combs being acquitted of sex trafficking but found guilty of lesser charges involving transporting prostitutes. What is the big takeaway? Again, you have and should have and rightly do have views about the particular dispositions in America. We have the capacity under the First Amendment to speak out about those publicly, privately, and you have the right to express views about the dispositions of both of those cases, about any case, criminal or civil, in America. What we can all agree on, is we have processes in this nation, again, at a time when we are celebrating this weekend the independence of our nation. Admittedly, 249 years ago, but the continuing systems of justice in this nation that afford you the right, number one, to be told what the government is charging you with. They give you the right to confront witnesses against you. They give you the right to review the documents, the information assembled by the criminal prosecutors. Give you the right to have counsel. That's also a constitutional right. Your opportunity to be heard in court, pretrial proceedings and trial proceedings as well, give you the opportunity to testify in your own behalf if you'd like to do that, to cross-examine witnesses brought against you, even after a jury verdict, which you've got a right to as well, even after a plea itself is just chock full of procedural safeguards, the judge asking you what you did and ensuring that you're understanding completely your waiver of your right to trial. All of that is a part of the American system of justice that we should embrace and acknowledge, even with its imperfections and its inadequacies, still works. Both of these defendants will be sentenced. And in that sentencing proceeding, they have a right once again to speak to the judges about the disposition of their cases. The public has the right to come in, the family members, to talk about what happened to the victims of those crimes. If there are any appellate proceedings, none likely in the Idaho case, but perhaps in the New York case, there again, more process, more procedure availed to you in America by virtue of our system of constitutional law and statutory law as well. And so it is a good thing on the 249th anniversary of our nation that we recognize that in the criminal arena, we afford defendants rightly an awful lot of very good and decent and appropriate procedure and process. We call it due process in the civil side as well. We'll talk next week about this major case involving Paramount and the decision to dispose of that case, a $16 million settlement of that 60 Minutes lawsuit. There again, you have a right to disagree about what will likely happen there. But you've also understand, as you do, that that process as well, a result of charges made, of discovery conducted, of depositions taken, and of a process that may be imperfect and may be inadequate and may be incomplete, that results in the end with a disposition. Again, an awful lot of people in all of those three cases, including the Paramount CBS News case, having very strong views, which is also a part of our system here in the United States of America. We celebrate that. And we honor that on the 4th of July, this 4th of July, this Independence Day weekend, when we come to you from Civic Media. A couple more things just to note about the Department of Justice as we go forward beyond the 249th year into the 250th year. That is some announcements coming out of the Department of Justice. Justice Department announcing that it's aggressively prioritizing efforts to strip some Americans of their U.S. citizenship established. So the department just this past week directing attorneys to prioritize denaturalization in cases involving naturalized citizens who commit certain crimes and giving United States attorneys throughout the 93 districts in our nation wide discretion on when to pursue this tactic, according to a mid-June memorandum that was distributed from the Attorney General to U.S. attorneys nationwide. Also, senior Justice Department officials are now exploring whether they can bring criminal charges against state or local election officials if the Trump administration determines they have not sufficiently safeguarded their voting computer systems, department's effort, again, it's early stages, according to what the department is saying, not based on any new evidence or data, but premised upon this continuing unsubstantiated argument that American elections are easy prey to voter fraud. The Department of Justice now exploring whether they can bring criminal charges against state officials, the clerks, presumably other people, if they fail to provide sufficient safeguards in their computer systems. Again, no evidence that that's been done in the past, the failure to provide that, but that is coming out of the Department of Justice as well. We know that there are spokespeople for the Department of Justice that are conferring and confirming that indeed the Department of Justice is going down that road with respect to some future possible criminal charges against election officials, even while, again, in another area, another pursuit inside the Department of Justice, directing these efforts to strip Americans of their citizenship. Denaturalization, the president has spoken a lot of that about that in recent times. It was a tactic that is heavily used during the McCarthy era, 1940s, early 1950s, expanded a bit during the Obama administration and grew further during President Trump's first term. It's meant to strip citizenship from those who may have lied about their criminal convictions or membership in illegal groups on their citizenship applications. Denaturalization, again, appropriately applied in some circumstances, a concern if it is applied to people who have not fallen into those categories of people who have failed to be honest about their naturalization process. All of that coming out of your United States Department of Justice just this past week. When we return next week, more things, more activities, more events in the areas of law and government and the administration of justice here in the United States of America. Have a good Independence Day weekend, everybody. Take care.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Steel.
I'm Christopher Cruz. It's an agonizing, heartbreaking weekend for the parents of 23 girls missing from a sleepaway summer camp near San Antonio after flash flooding. At least 24 bodies were recovered yesterday. CBS's Jason Allen says rescuers aren't giving up.
This is still being called an active rescue mission. There have been helicopter teams and boat teams going up the Guadalupe River. They're having to sort through, work around these huge piles of debris, and they have even been scanning the treetops, looking for people who may still be waiting to be rescued.
The river rose 26 feet in 45 minutes. More rain is in the forecast today, with the potential for pockets of heavy downpours. Tropical storm Chantal has formed off the coast of the Carolinas. Stand by for more tariff-related uncertainty, a preview from CBS's Willie James Inman at the White House.
The president